From Buck's studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, why do we feel cold more in the fall when the weather's getting colder than we do in the spring when the weather's getting warmer? In other words, 50 degrees in the fall feels different than 50 degrees in the spring. We'll talk about some science that might be behind this.
If you say so.
And a mother's voice in a smoke alarm might be far better than a ringing sound. At least that's what some research shows about. Think about your mother and whether or not her voice would correspond and make you actually get up and get out of the house. We'll talk about alarms, kids, and adults. I can hear my mother's voice right now. My mother never swore, by the way, so she would just say, get out of the house. But there would be a way she would say it that definitely would go into my brain.
Got it. And our recipe?
Chicken tinga poblana. It is a wonderful Latin comfort food recipe, and we have a guest chef.
Your calls as well at 800-462-7413. Zorba, our first caller, is a listener in Brooklyn, New York. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, very well. If you don't mind, I'm going to just give you a couple of parameters, and then I have my question, and I'll let you take off with it. I'm 57 years old. I've had high blood pressure since the age of 17, but interestingly enough, never started taking meds for it till I turned 50. You know, I had a high bottom number for years of 88 to 90, 92, and back then, that was considered what they called the high normal. Now, though, that would be considered high. So at age 50, I started taking lisinopril, 10 milligrams, and about 5 years ago, they doubled it to 20. And now I get no more blood pressure headaches at all. I used to get one or two a week, and now they're practically gone. At the age of 30, a bout with diverticulitis led me to realize you cannot eat salami every day of your life. So I cut out the salami. I cut out the bacon in the morning, you know, all those nitrates, hot dogs. And I bought myself a juicer and used it for about a year and sort of cleansed myself and got rid of the diver without any medications or hospitalization. Thank goodness for that. Now, here's my question, Dr. Zorba. For about 25 years now, this is my routine. Breakfast, I start with a banana. Now, this is Monday to Friday. Mm-hmm. I start with a banana. Then I have a little bit later, I have an apple, a pear, an orange. Then I'll have the real peanut butter, none of that sugary stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, on the seven-grain bread.
Okay, good stuff.
And then lunch, before lunch, a little cottage cheese, a little herring. Sometimes I cheat in cream sauce. Sometimes it's not in cream sauce. And then I'll have a nice sandwich, maybe ham or tuna or salmon, something like that. Dinner is brown rice and vegetables or whole wheat, hot and vegetables.
Excellent.
Monday to Friday.
Excellent.
I'm terrific.
Uh-huh.
Now, on Saturday, all hell breaks loose. On Saturday, it's a huge Brooklyn bagel with cream cheese, right? Maybe an omelet with more cheese, ham and cheese, or whatever, something like that. I might have a donut. Mm-hmm. I might have a croissant Saturday.
Sure.
Lunch, you know, lunches, again, would be maybe some of that salami I didn't have all week. And dinner might be, you know, white pasta, linguine with clam sauce. So my question is, I look at it as the score is 5-2. I've got 5 good days, 2 that aren't. And my question is, are my 2 days that aren't good, am I wiping out my previous 5?
No, you're not. By the way, I like the concept of a score of 5-2. I think it's a great concept because the reality is people think when they have to change their diet, and like you said, your diet Monday through Friday is really good. They have to change their diet. They have to change it 100% of their time, and they can't do it. I mean, it's very difficult. Diets have changed over time in our society, but getting to 100% is very difficult for the vast majority of the population. So 5-2 is very good. 6-1 would be better, but 5-2 is good. It doesn't have to be 7-0 in order to win the game. And one of the things I would do, I think what you're doing is fine. You look at the food, like you said, you know, herring can be a little bit higher in salt and salami, but the reality is salt is much more of a minor role than we have previously thought. It is a role for people who have congestive heart failure, but for normal people, there is no evidence now that salt actually destroys the kidney. I mean, for years, on and off, the question has been, does sodium actually do something bad to the kidney? And the answer is it isn't. But what I would just do on the weekend is I would just add some more fruits and vegetables. That's what I would do.
Right. Well, yeah, I will. Once in a while, I will add that in. Because, again, thinking I'm balanced.
I think that you are doing a really, really good job. And 5-2, hey, it's a winning score. I think you hit it right in the head.
I just want to add one thing. I made the mistake of saying cheating, and I've learned don't use the word cheating. Use the word reward.
Rewarding. I love it. What a nuance.
Thank you so
You're
much.
Welcome.
For your
you
time.
Keep,
I appreciate
you keep up the good work. Thanks for sharing
Thank
that.
We appreciate that call at 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, you say a 50-degree day feels colder in the fall than in the spring.
Of course it does. You know that. Don't you feel a difference?
I think that's a bunch of baloney.
It is not a bunch of baloney. And when it's 50 degrees and it's fall, I go, my God, I have to really bundle up, go outside. I kind of think about
you
it.
Don't
it's really
think any
there.
Of that.
100%. I absolutely think
I've
about
it. I've seen you outside in 50-degree weather
not,
and you have your swimming suit on.
It is not the swimming suit on. But in the springtime, you can just see it. You know, on a university campus, first of all, the kids in the university, they wear T-shirts all year round with shorts. But the reality is it feels different in the springtime than it does in the fall time. That's what I think, and frankly, what I think is what's true. That's what I wanted to say. But it is true. I've talked about this with other people, and the fact is people do feel a little bit differently. Now there's some interesting things. First of all, we know that bigger people have more of a surface area, so the question is, do they feel cold more? And the answer is, I don't believe that at all, because you've got some very tall college students, and they dress up the same way as very short college students. So I don't buy that. What I do buy is there's an acclimation that goes on, and I will give you a personal example. This is a personal study. Back a few years ago, as you know, I was in Nepal and Tibet, and we were off the grid for a month. We were generally at about 12 to 14,000 feet during most of that time. Highest pass we went over was 18.5. That's pretty high. At the top of the pass, it was cold. Not Wisconsin cold. It was probably like a little thermometer on. It was like 15 degrees, blowing wind like a flurry and maybe an inch or two of snow on the top. People from California, though, were freezing. They're going, oh, my goodness. I can't stand this all. People, my good friend who is from Calgary, Canada, said, you don't know what cold is. You should have walked to school the way I did. Uphill both ways in a snowstorm. But he was from Calgary. I was from Wisconsin. We experienced that cold differently. And interestingly, at the end of a month of being relatively cold, because most of the temperature was really, it got up to maybe 34, 36 degrees. When we got down in lower elevation, and it was like 45 degrees, we're ready to shed all of our clothes literally and walk around in bathing suits. You do acclimate to the cold, and science doesn't have the foggiest idea how it actually happens.
Well, that shows that people that live in really warm weather all the time are more affected by cold than people
live in cold weather.
That's different than spring
and
fall.
That's right. Well, I'm just going off in many different ways. I haven't explained it. It is a perceptual issue. The other perceptual issue might be that in the springtime, you know, the days are going to get warmer. You know, the days are longer, you know, 50 degrees in the springtime. The days are longer than 50 degrees often in the fall, at least in Wisconsin. Now, I don't know if it's the same thing for people who live in warmer climates, such as Arizona and California. They often feel cold when it's like 60 degrees because they're used to the cold.
Well, you and I live in the same place, essentially.
Do you find a difference?
No.
Oh, well, that's, you know, I mean, you know, you must live in the warmer climate of Madison, and I live in the colder climate of Oregon. The village of Oregon, by the way, not the state, which is Oregon.
1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Let's bundle up now and welcome a caller in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
It's such a delight to be able to talk to you both. I think this show provides such a good service, you know, giving sound medical advice and making people laugh, which is good for the health.
Thank you. And you are right. Laughing is good. Joy is a very important part of life, and laughing is usually when we're happy and joyous. So that's very good. Thank you.
So I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroid disease about 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And as time went on, I needed more higher dose of the medicine. And then last year, I was up to 100 micrograms. And then last spring, I started experiencing a little bit of nervousness mm-hmm. and a faster heartbeat. And so I asked my doctor to have my levels checked.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
So apparently, I was able to go on a lower dose.
Okay.
And so I'm wondering about that. And also, I've been reading the book 10% Human, and the author points out the very important functions that microbes perform for our systems to operate. And I was wondering if there's been any, if you know of research about microbes affecting the thyroid.
Well, first of all, you had a lower dose of thyroid. You started to experience some side effects. Take it, your doctor measured levels, said, hey, maybe you're on too high a dose, and then put you on a lower dose of thyroid medicine?
Yes.
Okay. How do you feel now?
I feel good.
Good. That, by the way, is not unusual. We often have to recheck the dose of thyroid medication. That's why we do it at least once a year if people have symptoms, because the body changes, and sometimes they need a higher dose and sometimes a lower dose, and it has to be fine-tuned. And that's
probably
the thing. Now, we're the microbiome, and I never know exactly how to pronounce it, whether it's the biome or biome, what lives in our gut and what lives in our body and how it affects health. We are only beginning to understand that. And it's becoming more and more important, especially, for instance, when we have discovered that some people who get a fecal transplant, they literally get poop from someone else, all of a sudden get rid of their, their inflammatory bowel disease. It's quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about just ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, which we don't cure by that right now. But I'm talking about people who have colon problems for years and all of a sudden they get better. You know, well, what happened? What happened to a great extent often is due to antibiotics that we give to people. There was a recent article that was published in the British Medical Journal that looked at obesity in children. And believe it or not, there was a correlation with antibiotics that they got as infants and obesity that they had when they were 5 years old. Hmm. And the question is, are we changing the microbe flora and, you know, within our gut from this? Getting back to your question about thyroid disease, I haven't seen any research. There may be some research that's on it right now. And there may indeed be some things in the gut that actually affect how our brain actually produces, you know, the thyroid gland gets information from the pituitary in the brain.
Okay.
It then sends it to the thyroid. It says, hey, you've got to produce more. You've got to produce less. We know that. We know that those things actually occur. But where it actually, how it fits in the biome, I don't think we really know.
Wow.
You know, so when you read about this, you know, it's all conjecture at this point. Now, conjecture is actually the first step in good science. People think, hey, maybe this works and maybe that doesn't work. They then do an experiment, 99% of them fail, and then one of them works. And that turns out to be how technology and science develops. So thinking about the gut has become a major research phenomena within medicine today.
That's interesting. But there's no research yet how it affects the thyroid?
Well, there may be research. I just haven't seen it. You know, I'd have to do a PubMed review. So there may be research.
Yeah.
And frankly, if there's not research today, I would not be surprised if there's research tomorrow or in the near future, because more and more we understand how the gut affects the body. We just don't know what we should or should not be doing to the gut.
Okay.
That's really the
important.
But in the meantime, we do know one thing. Taking thyroid medication makes a huge difference. And we know that the synthetic thyroid medication that has been developed in my lifetime has been a boon to people who have thyroid problems. When I first started medicine, the only thing you could get was either pork-derived thyroid from the pork gland of pigs or beef-derived thyroid gland. It was made by Armour and Company. They're the slaughtering people. And it really wasn't very good. It was very hard to regulate because it was hard to get the purity of that. And now that we've developed a far better medication, we've made a huge difference in thyroid disease.
Yeah, but why do you think so many people, especially women, have this disease today?
Very good question.
Well, that's a good answer.
It's a very good question. That's a very good question.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Great question. To be answered in the future, that's all I can say.
All right. Thank you.
You take care.
Thanks. We appreciate that. Call at 800-462-7413.
Wasn't that a good question? That was a good question.
That's right. And before that, I really liked your definition. They're the slaughtering people.
You caught that.
Before we take a quick break, Zorba, you look like you're having a little too much fun today. So let's give your naysayers a voice by firing up another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Okay, Zorba, here's an email we received that addresses something you said on a recent show about arthritis. The emailer writes, "Hi, Dr. Z. I heard you mention that you do not see people with badly curled hands anymore. You said you thought it was from the use of anti-inflammatories. But I think it's because people do not work with their hands like in the old days."
Mm-hmm.
Just an observation.
Sure.
What do you think?
Well, that might be part of the issue. But many of the people who I saw years ago at the beginning of my practice with hands that were curled were often women who did not engage in manual labor in factories. They were often women who, you know, raised a family, lived at home, were in our small town. They didn't work on the farm. So I'm not really sure manual labor plays a role, but it surely does play a role. But I think anti-inflammatories also play a role.
Yeah, as far as women, a lot of them are raising kids, and that takes a lot
That's true. I really don't remember if the women that I saw at the beginning of my practice had 10 to 15 or 20 children, and whether or not that was a function of the arthritis. But you know what? Maybe I'll do research on that, and I'll try to find out.
We're waiting. Do you disagree with Zorba? Let us know by posting on our Facebook page or by sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Tasty recipe coming up, a guest chef. You'll want to stick around for that. More of your calls, of course, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. But, Zorba, before our next call, time again for our recipe. And this time, Zorba, we have quite a treat. Today, we have a special guest author joining in on the fun. Ingrid Hoffman is the host of several food-forward television shows, including Top Chef Estrellas on Telemundo NBC. Her brand new book is called Latin Comfort Foods Made Healthy, More Than 100 Diabetes-Friendly Latin Favorites. And it was a collaboration with the American Diabetes Association. She joins us now to share one of her recipes from the book. It's for a traditional Mexican stew, and it's called Chicken Tinga Poblana. Ingrid, we welcome you to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here.
Good to have you. How did you get into this book?
You know, it's been a long road. I think that my direction change with food really began when I was diagnosed with lupus.
Mm-hmm. And when was that?
This was in 2002. Uh-huh. But I have to tell you that it changed my life for the better.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. it turns out that, you know, I had been so ill, mm-hmm. and when I started treatment, it made me even worse, and I really didn't have any quality of life, mm-hmm. and I sort of started, you know, asking my doctors, what is my body reacting to? What sure. should I not eat? Mm-hmm. What should I eat? And, mm-hmm. you know, in that day and age, medicine
right.
was
right.
very much like, take your pill and go home.
Right.
So it was a very lonely time, because mm-hmm. you're sitting there trying to figure it out, but you're really not getting answers. So I embarked on a lot
of research. It's very interesting that you say a lonely time, because that's it. You know, you don't have the internet is in its infancy. We're talking about 16, 17 years ago. So you don't have lupus websites. You don't have Facebook. And so you're there, and your doctor is saying, take your pills. But you don't have anywhere to turn and say, what do I do with my lifestyle to change my lifestyle? And you hit it right on the head when you said it was lonely, because the internet makes things not lonely. All of a sudden, you can be with other people who have the same problem and exchange information.
You know, and you hit it on the nail with the timeline and everything mm-hmm. that was going on at the time. And we also didn't have a lot of functional integrative medicine.
Correct.
So I started the research on my own and little by little, you know, experimenting on myself. And I'll tell you that I haven't taken medicine and I can't remember mm-hmm. how many years. I live a full-on active life. Mm-hmm. I feel better in my menopause and 53 years old that I ever did as a young woman. And mm-hmm. I have more energy, mm-hmm. and I just live a very full, active life.
So you decided that. I mean, Latin comfort foods are not necessarily known to be diabetic friendly.
Well, Latin comfort foods are not known to be anything friendly, to tell you the truth.
But they taste good.
they taste good. But when you can make them actually taste better mm-hmm. and healthy mm-hmm. and where you can say, I'm eating clean, but I'm eating delicious food. I'm not
right.
going to go have lettuce leaves with lime on it and grilled chicken for the rest of your life.
Right.
Green juices.
Right.
It's about flavoring food the proper way. It's about having the right amounts. It's about introducing fiber into mm-hmm. every single recipe
right.
that you make so that it can help you metabolize. And it's about adding vegetables. It's there's so many, you know, we now have the help of so many great products that we can find on shelves and in that are clean and better for you than we had been seeing in the last 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
So,
no, you're right, because I was looking through, you know, your book. You have Perico scrambled eggs. I'm not sure how to pronounce Pericos, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but you use eggs and egg whites so that you increase the protein of the recipe without increasing the cholesterol in the recipe. And Spanish tortilla with cauliflower and potato, which looks absolutely wonderful, brothy mushroom soup, and then, of course, the recipe that we're going to do today, but Latin goddess, green goddess salad, and a salad dressing, wonderful, wonderful recipes, just really great recipes. We just
thank you. I'm very proud. This is my fifth book, but I have to tell you that I feel that it is the book that is the most helpful for people, because
if you can see the, like, for instance, the recipe that we're discussing, the chicken tinga poblana, that comes in at 200 calories.
Oh, yeah. No, it is really, it is excellent. So I'm going to go into the recipe. It's wonderful. It starts out with 1 pound of boneless, skinless chicken breasts. Excellent. You know, so we have something with very low fat, almost no fat at all in it. 2 bay leaves. You use no added salt, diced tomatoes. Good idea. That, you know, anytime we can cut down on salt, it's always a good idea. And salt is always added. And then use some chopped fresh cilantro. What do you put in for people who don't like cilantro? I mean, that's the world is divided into cilantro lovers and cilantro not lovers. What herb would you use?
Parsley works great. And by the way, I don't know if you're aware, but the cilantro is a gene. Either you have a gene that makes you taste it like soap or not.
That's right. Yeah. And luckily in our family, we don't have the gene, so we're okay. It doesn't taste like soap. And then 2 tablespoonfuls of adobo sauce from Chipotle, the little canned of there.
I'd like to add that this is a can of dried, smoked chiles.
Mm-hmm.
They come in vinegar. So it's a very, although it's canned, it's a very clean, there's no added things into that. So you're having, literally, it's a chile that has been smoked, dried, and now is in vinegar. So it's in the can category, it's a good can to have in your pantry.
Right.
And it gives tons of flavor.
Right. Tablespoonful of cider vinegar, couple cloves of garlic, half teaspoon of dried thyme, and a half teaspoon of dried marjoram or oregano, little 1/8 teaspoon of salt, canola oil, and onion. Why don't you make the recipe for us?
You know, it's such a simple to do. And actually, this is one of the recipes that really works well to pre-batch mm-hmm. and make ahead and
Ooh.
Freeze because
huh.
of the liquid and the tomatoes. So I am one that I always say to people, there's certain recipes that work really well. Make triple, save
Excellent
it in,
mm-hmm.
in portions in your freezer. Mm-hmm. That way you cooked once, you cleaned once, you dirtied once, eat a few times. You know, this is basically we boil the chicken in the leaves for just 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
People sometimes tend to
mm-hmm.
over boil chicken. Now
okay.
it's got all the herbs in it,
mm-hmm.
the bay leaves that gives it flavor. Just 15 minutes, you take it out, you let it cool.
Mm-hmm.
Later, you shred it. In
mm-hmm.
the meantime, with you saute some onion
mm-hmm.
and you puree the tomatoes
mm-hmm.
with the cilantro, with the chipotle, chiles, with the adobo sauce in which the chiles come, the vinegar, the garlic, the thyme, the marjoram. And you blend that.
Mm-hmm.
And then once your onions have been sauteed,
mm-hmm.
you add this tomato, spicy, smoky.
Right. Delicious.
Starchy, delicious,
mm-hmm.
herby
mm-hmm.
broth to the onions. And you put the chicken in,
that's it.
Done.
It's great. I love this. And I love the fact that you just brought up a really important point about freezing the recipe. For parents who have children, it's wonderful to be able to freeze things and then have something that's tasty, delicious, and heart healthy. And this recipe is fabulous. Just 200 calories, very little calories from fat. Wonderful. And what I like about the book is there are basic nutritional values on every single one and exchanges for diabetics, choices and exchanges, whether or not it has starchy
Correct.
Vegetables or not.
Yeah.
It's
now,
a wonderful book.
Thank you so much. This recipe, when I want to turn it into a one-pot meal,
mm-hmm.
then I will add chopped zucchini to the onions that I'm sauteing,
mm-hmm.
and I will add spinach. And it could be frozen
uh-huh.
organic spinach, too. Now you have a much thicker. Now
right.
it's not
right.
just a protein.
Right.
Now it's a one-dish wonder.
Right.
And then you can serve it on top of quinoa or on top of some brown rice
it's
or
wonderful.
Inside of a sweet potato, and you have a full-on meal.
Inside of a sweet potato. That sounds good, too. We have to have you on the show when you do your next cookbook. Thank you. Thank you so much. Latin Comfort Foods, made healthy, delicious food. I highly recommend it. I think it's a classic book. And, of course, it's in English and in Spanish. My 4 children all speak Spanish. They all lived in Mexico for 6 months to a year. 2 of them lived in Argentina. 2 lived in Spain. I'm going to give them this book as a present.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Yes. thank you for having me. And the book is available nationwide in bookstores and online.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for doing this. You're doing a great job.
Thanks for having me.
And to get a copy of today's special guest chef recipe, Zorba, how do we do that?
You go to the website, zorbapastor.org, or, of course, through Facebook.
Now, Zorba, back to the phones. We welcome a listener in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Yeah, I heard that if you eat and then go to bed, that you can have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Is that true or not?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. What, there are some interesting issues that have to do with digestion, going to sleep, waking up. So you heard if you eat certain foods before you go to bed or any food?
Oh, any food.
Mm-hmm. What time you normally go to sleep?
Approximately any time between 10 and 1.
10 and 1. And then what time do you eat dinner?
Maybe 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. Okay, 8 o'clock at night. So, 2 to 3 hours before you go to sleep. When you wake up, you have a good breakfast in the morning when you wake up? Do you have any breakfast?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I don't get hungry until, maybe 12 or 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. And a couple of reasons I'm asking this. What's your height? What's your weight?
My height is 5'7", and I'm about 168, I'm pretty normal.
Yeah, so you're pretty normal. So it's very interesting. So something that's interesting is you're going through about a 12-hour fast every day, a 12 to 14-hour fast, because you eat at 8 o'clock in the evening, and then you don't eat until 1 o'clock, 12 or 1 o'clock the next day. So, and a lot of people who fast actually eat too much. That's one of the reasons. You don't. You have a good regulated body. But a lot of people who fast that long all of a sudden get very hungry, and they eat too much food. The answer, the short answer is no. You can eat something before you go to sleep, and it does not cause a heart attack. But the other answer that's very interesting is that more heart attacks occur in the morning when you wake up, especially between 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning. So when we wake up our bodies, that's actually the time that we're often prone to heart attacks for a whole bunch of reasons that we do and don't understand. First of all, for some people, their blood pressure pills are just not working as well when they wake up in the morning. And waking up, our blood pressure increases, and it may increase too much. That's one theory. The other theory is that it may have to do with what's going on in our body when we're sleeping, when we're actually sleeping. So having a big meal and just going to sleep right away might affect the body differently. I've never seen any data that shows having a big meal before you go to sleep at night causes heart attacks, but it might be that what you eat really does make a difference. So I always tell people, don't go to sleep right after you eat. You should stay up for another hour or two. There's no evidence. One question people have is, if I have a lot of calories before I go to sleep, am I more likely to become fat? And the answer is, if you have more calories, too many calories throughout the day, you're more likely to become fat. But yeah. It is true. When you eat, if you walk around, it does improve digestion. The stuff goes through the gut quicker, and it feels better. So. I don't think it causes heart attacks, but I don't think it's a great idea. So, how's your diet? What sort of food do you eat?
Well, it's basically mostly Mexican food.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's good Mexican food. Well, Mexican food is always good. There's healthy Mexican food, and there's Mexican food that's not as healthy. You obviously don't get too many calories at your height and at your weight. Do you eat fruits and vegetables?
Oh yeah, a lot of that.
That's important.
Yeah, a lot.
And the thing is, in El Paso, you can get plentiful fruits and vegetables throughout summer, fall, winter, and spring. Up here in Wisconsin in the north, although we get it, it's more expensive, and it's not, a lot of it is shipped from the south, from Texas and California and other places. So, Well, keep eating right. Keep doing what you're doing. Don't have a big meal before you go to sleep. But let me put away the myth. Eating late at night before you go to sleep does not cause a heart attack.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for bringing that up. You take care now.
We appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Now, before the break, Zorba, time for the segment where you clarify something a listener has read on the internet. It's called Google Doc.
I I need castanets. I have said that before, but I have not received my pair of castanets for this. What is coming down to this world? I need my castanets.
In any case, the following email came to us from a listener named Danielle in Wisconsin. Dr. Zorba, I read your article on daily aspirin, and it was convincing enough that I stopped taking aspirin. Today, I did a little more research to find out that stopping a daily aspirin regimen can also be dangerous. After seeing that, I went back to taking the aspirin after a 3-day break. I'm a 54-year-old male and in good health. I've controlled mild hypertension, not a perfect cholesterol profile, but does not require medication, no prior heart attacks or stroke. So, do you feel I put myself at increased risk by stopping for 3 days? I contacted my regular doctor and haven't heard back yet, but wanted to get your thoughts, too.
Well, first of all, there's no danger in stopping aspirin. That's bunk. Now, for people who need to be on aspirin, for instance, people who have had a previous heart attack, stopping it means the aspirin is no longer there, but there's no danger in stopping it. So that's junk on the net. Mm-hmm. You can stop aspirin anytime you want to. And the data now shows for primary prevention, in other words, aspirin does not prevent you from having that first heart attack. We know people who have had heart attacks benefit from aspirin, but the idea of taking aspirin to prevent from having a heart attack now pretty much is biting the dust. And it's going to take a while before everybody is on board with that, but the data is pretty good on that. So I think he should stop the aspirin, not go back on the aspirin, but quit the aspirin completely. And hopefully he will eventually receive some sort of a response from his doctor.
Yes, let's hope. So one does not need a daily aspirin unless he or she has a heart attack.
Well, yeah. The data on, after you've had a heart attack, the data on taking an aspirin every day is irrefutable. It's really good data, period. Those people should stay on aspirin. But we thought it would prevent a first heart attack if it was good for people who had had a heart attack. And the answer is, now the data shows it doesn't do that. Why? Well, I don't know. You know, obviously, after you've had a heart attack, your body just may be different than before. That's all we know.
Mm-hmm. Did you read something online that you're not quite sure about? Zorba's here to clarify the clickbait. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up. Another interesting topic to talk about at our medical Mythbuster segment. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, you have some alarming research to talk about.
Alarming research on alarms in the house. And I found this really interesting research from the journal Pediatrics. And what they did is they wanted to see what would motivate kids to get up when a smoke alarm went off. And if you're a parent, this is something that is really, really important, mm-hmm. really important to you. And I find it fascinating because it's actually an easy fix for this. So researchers recruited nearly 200 kids who were 5 to 12 years old to test alarms out. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was like 12, I mean, you know, there were thunderstorms that didn't wake up. In Chicago, the Sox won the pennant and the air raid sirens went off. And I was upset because I slept through the air raid sirens. Everyone thought that the commies were coming to bomb the city, but in the end, it was just that the Sox finally won the pennant. Yeah, by the way, Mayor Daley got into a lot of trouble with that. But anyway, they monitored the kids with EEG electrodes, looking at their brain in the deep stages until they entered the deep stages of sleep. And then they set off two tones. Mm-hmm. The first tone was the standard alarm tone. Ah, you know, that tone. Yeah. You know, maybe you push the button. So that was the first tone. The second one was the mother's recorded voice shouting the child's name.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Now, I don't know about you, but I can hear my mother shouting at me right now. I can just picture the way, the tone of her voice. Everyone knows her mother's shout. Most people, I would say, pretty much everybody. Okay. So in the study, and as I said, in pediatrics, the tone alarm woke the kids only 50% of the time. In other words, in the deep stages of sleep, the kids slept through the alarm, and it took them an average of 5 minutes to get out of the room. In other words, they woke up, but they couldn't get out of the room by themselves. It took them 5 minutes to get out of the room. Guess what the mother's voice did.
They got to get up quicker.
90%. 50% of the kids got up with the regular alarm. 90% of the kids got up with the mother's voice, and they got out of the rooms in a half a minute, 30 seconds versus 5 minutes. It was like, oh, my God, that's my mom. And they woke up, and they had, you know, they got out of the room.
Yeah. I don't ever remember my mom raising her voice.
Oh, I remember my mother raising her voice. I can remember my Aunt Shirley raising. Well, maybe your mother didn't. But your mother calls you in a certain way. And the issue is, it's really easy to develop smoke alarms where you could record the alarm and what the alarm says.
Yeah, sure.
Because, I mean, I have a book that I read to my granddaughter, Bella, and I can record things in the book. And I think this shows you that maybe some alarms should be, get out of the house, get out of the house, get out of the house. Using your mother's alarm. And maybe we'll have a whole series of alarms, like to wake up in the morning and other things. But moms move children quicker from their voice than an alarm on a regular smoke alarm.
800-462-7413 is our number. 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba. A listener with us in Edmond, Oklahoma. Hi.
Salutations.
Yeah, how can we help?
Well, I had a question about sleep and narcolepsy, and is it really just falling asleep like a fainting goat, or do you feel yourself gradually falling asleep?
Well, it depends. For some people, they gradually fall asleep, and for other people, they don't. I had a patient of mine, and her husband would commonly get out of the car, walk over, and open the door for his wife, and sometimes he'd go in the house, and he'd realize his wife never got out of the car. She said, oh, thank you, and then fell asleep. And so he'd have to walk outside. I mean, he stopped doing that after a while, but his wife would be in the car and have drop attacks. A lot of people with narcolepsy fall asleep at the wheel. It's the first evidence. They're driving down the road, and all of a sudden they're in a crash, and they fell asleep at the wheel in the middle of the day. So some have drop attacks, some do not. Cataplexy is the is sort of a variation of narcolepsy where you have a drop attack. But other people just feel tired, and then they go to sleep, and they know they're going to be going to sleep so they can get themselves into a safe environment, like pull the car over to the side of the road, or they actually sit down. If they're walking, they may sit on the ground so they don't fall. Do you have narcolepsy?
I've got severe sleep apnea, and they suspect that I've got narcolepsy as well, because I've been falling asleep periodically, just random times throughout the day.
Uh-huh. How old are you?
26.
26. So sleep apnea, what's your height, what's your weight?
6'1", 170.
Okay, so you're not overweight, so it's central. I mean, a lot of people are overweight. You are not overweight at 6'6", 170. You've had a sleep apnea test, and they put you on CPAP, the machine, to help you sleep?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. And what's happened with that? Has that helped at all?
Hasn't really helped. I've been feeling super tired throughout the day. They prescribed a modafinil, Provigil,
okay.
And that's helped.
Provigil. So you take that in the morning? When do you take it?
One in the morning and then one around noon.
Around noontime, yeah. Often you need to have that second burst and that second dose. What do you do for a living?
I'm a stay-at-home dad. I'm a disabled veteran.
Uh-huh. So you stay at home. You've got to be awake for the kids. I mean, that's really obviously an important thing. But you don't operate heavy machinery. What happens? Do you drive? Are you driving?
Yeah, I drive a lot.
Okay. So have you ever fallen asleep at the wheel? Or are you worried about that? Has that occurred?
A couple times I've fallen asleep, but I was able to pull over. I haven't had any wrecks or anything from it.
How long was it before you knew you had a pullover? I mean, we've all been sleeping. Well, I've been sleepy in a car. Most of us have been in a car. We've been sleepy, and we know, hey, I'm really sleepy. I've got to pull over, get some coffee, or go. How much of a signal do you get before you actually fall asleep?
Not much of a signal at all. Maybe like a minute or two. And well, I tried drinking coffee and stuff, and it does not help.
No, it won't in a case like that. But a minute or two is an okay signal versus I've got to go to sleep, and all of a sudden, 15 seconds later, you're in a deep sleep. But you surely have to be careful with that. So, how long ago did this begin to develop? How old were you?
I would say probably about 23.
Uh-huh. Do they think it's at all related to the injuries that you've sustained as a disabled vet?
I mean, I've been trying. They keep denying it, my sleep apnea and stuff.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Because you're young to have sleep apnea. As far as narcolepsy, it does occur at younger ages because that could be the case. But sleep apnea in somebody, with, 6 feet and 170 is such an unusual thing. You would wonder whether or not some of the environment that you were in, I don't know, were you in an environment where your head might have shaken or in an environment where you might have had a brain injury?
Well, I had blunt force trauma to the spine, and it's affected my neck, and I get tension headaches.
I'll tell you something. The more that we learn about brain and concussive injuries, the more upsetting it is. We now know, nobody talked about football injuries years ago, yet they were happening. And we knew it happened in boxers, but nobody even thought about football. And nobody thought about kids, the fact that kids who play football in high school, after a certain number of injuries, it can affect their brain 20 years and 30 years later. So one of the things that I don't think we have a clear answer is, and it's moving forward, is the fact that exactly what sort of injuries do veterans get when they're in serious environments where their head is basically shaken and the brain rocks against the skull. And, certainly there's a possibility that your stuff is related to that. I don't think we know quite yet, but you got to keep at it because just like Agent Orange, that was denied for years as being a cause of anything. And then finally one day science came in and said, no, it actually was a cause of a lot of things. And it may be the same for what you had. Getting back to what has Provigil, Modafinil, great drug. You may have to be on more of that, and you may have to be on different drugs in addition to that. And then the other thing is, do you nap during the day? Does that help?
I try to nap, but it doesn't really help.
Doesn't really help, yeah. And it often doesn't. It may help with sleep apnea, but it doesn't necessarily help with narcolepsy. Well, Kiba, there are new drugs on the market. The drugs that you're on are correct, and the main thing is to make sure when you're driving, you're in a safe environment, you're okay, and especially with your kids. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
I appreciate it, Doc.
You're welcome. Thanks. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. We appreciate that call. Okay, Zorba, time now for our medical Mythbusters segment. This email comes to us from a listener named Sharon. She writes, Dr. Zorba, I want to know if eye drops are good for you. I saw on a TV show how a wife killed her husband by putting eye drops in his water for 3 days. Now I'm nervous about putting them in my eyes. Are they safe to use?
Well, maybe if you've got eye drops that contain poison, you put the drops in your eye, you'll actually kill somebody. Little cyanide eye drops, that'll certainly get you. They'd probably kill you if you put drops in your eyes, now that I think about it. And I don't think they manufacture cyanide eye drops. She's been watching too much television.
Too much TV is right.
Too much TV.
Don't watch that
That's
show
right.
anymore.
Yeah, get rid of that show that eye drops in the eye will actually kill the guy. There are a lot of different kinds of eye drops. There are eye drops that are for glaucoma, and there's eye drops to lubricate your eyes. But I think eye drops that are manufactured under good clinical practices are just okay, as long as they go in your eyes. But, hey, don't put it in the water, and don't try to poison your husband.
Have a potential myth for Zorba. Just post it to our Facebook page or drop us an email at...
Oh, Zorba at WBR.org. You know, these jokes are getting worse and worse and worse over time.
800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. Before we head out today, Zorba, let's pry open the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and share a listener email. This one came to us from George in Holcomb, Illinois, who writes...
Holcomb. Holcomb, Illinois.
Well, you're
Holcomb
from,
is a, but Holcomb is a word.
Yeah. Isn't it you're from Illinois. Isn't it a town in Illinois?
You think I know every town in Illinois? I've never heard of Holcomb. Sometimes you say people are saying Holcomb, and it means like, come on, you're joshing me.
That's a lot of Holcomb.
How would you like to be known from Holcomb, Illinois? That would be like Truth and Consequences, New Mexico. But Holcomb is not a common word. So, you know, I think if I asked my trainer what Holcomb was, he'd probably say? I think it's a town in Illinois.
Well, okay. All this joshing, I can't finish the email.
How about joshing, Illinois?
We're almost out of time.
Please, go on.
Dr. Zorba.
Holcomb is next to joshing, Illinois. There's Holcomb and then there's joshing.
Dr. Zorba, this is an old adage I'm sure you are familiar with.
Of course. Every adage. I'm familiar with every adage. I'm this, Dr.
This,
adage.
This one you know. What? Digging time. Your own grave
yes.
with a knife and fork.
Yes.
I see so many people around me who are obese.
That's right.
I've loved ones that are obese, mm-hmm. and the potential for them having serious mm-hmm. medical mm-hmm. problems worries me a great deal.
Right.
Heart problems, mm-hmm. type 2 diabetes,
right.
and the accompanying possible horrible circulatory
right.
problems and serious mobility issues at younger ages
right.
all come to mind.
Right.
Weight is a touchy subject to raise with
correct.
Loved ones and close friends. Is there a gentle way to broach the subject without causing damage to a relationship?
Well, first of all, you don't say, hey, you're too fat. We know that's not the good way. I'm still stuck on trying to dig my grave with a knife and fork and thinking about how long that would take, which is a long time. You know, there is no gentle way because for some people, you shouldn't say a word at all. They know they're overweight.
Yeah.
Why do you want to say anything to them? I mean, unless they ask you, why would you say it? Hey, you're overweight. Why don't you lose some weight?
No, if they're a loved one, you care about them, and you think maybe if you let them know that there are serious problems
yeah.
with overeating.
Do you think people who are overweight don't know their medical problems associated with it? I bet if we actually did a survey, 95% would know it's not healthy for them. Mm-hmm. Maybe 99%. You know, that's about it. And so the real issue is, how do you actually encourage healthy eating? You don't have to tell them anything. You can say, let's have some heart-healthy food and start mm-hmm. cooking for mm-hmm. them. The reality is you show people more by what you're doing than by what you're saying. And that's what counts.
Have a tricky question for us. Zorba is always happy to weigh in on the matter.
Oh, gosh.
Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at...
Zorba@WPR.org. And anyone who could figure out how long it would take to dig a grave with a knife and fork, please let me know, because I'm curious how many days it would actually take. The knife really doesn't hold very much. The fork, hardly anything.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast,
visit us on the web at zorbapastor.org or through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidman. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit zorbapastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.